You want kicking things out of orbit?
Oh my gosh!
I'm gonna just knock it sideways.
One of the greatest fighters.
John Jones beat every champion. Pretty much now.
Khabib gets his hands on McGregor to be that night.
Let's get into it.
Hello! You are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from UFC Fight Night: Blades versus Lewis, aka UFC Vegas 19. I will do all this at one half of the Fight Night Picks Preview Show. I'm speaking, of course, of the great Matt Allen. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. We've had some great fights recently. Glad to be back.
I'm glad to be back as well. I'm excited. All right, Matt. I want to do a little bit of a swerve at the top here. I want to talk about UFC 258. We did not talk about it last week because it was Valentine's Day and we both have big hearts. So we were elsewhere, both physically and emotionally. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start this show how we normally end this show, which is to do a rundown of that card. We'll do some quick hitters. So what I'm going to do is we'll talk takeaways, we'll talk all that, but I just want to give you a question from pretty much the main card and all the relevant fights. You can add whatever you want, but let's start with Kamaru Usman defeating Gilbert Burns. He did it in 3 rounds. The question that sticks out to me here, Matt, is Kamaru Usman overrated or underrated?
I got to be honest. I never thought I would say this really in my life, especially being a Canadian. He's the only fighter I can think of who might one day eclipse GSP as being like the GOAT at 170. Like, I really do think that there's no real weakness to his game. And when you think about fighters, especially guys at the top of their divisions, like the guys who jump out automatically, like the Israel Adesanyas, guys like Max Holloway, formerly, I guess, Volkanovski, like most guys are specialists. And you look at Usman, yes, he is a wrestler, but you just see how far his striking has progressed. Like, I don't know how you beat him anymore. You've seen him in there with basically pure strikers. You've seen him in there with other wrestlers. You've seen him in there with now jiu-jitsu guys who can strike really well. And nothing really phases him no matter what. And really the only fight out there for him at this point that we haven't already seen, I guess maybe Wonder Boy, or maybe like new and improved Leon Edwards. I understand they fought, but that was, you know, that wasn't really this modern day Leon Edwards, if you will. So for Usman, I think he's underrated. Like, I really do think one day he's going to go down as one of the greatest of all time. And say what you will, but Gilbert Burns, I saw a lot of people were hating on him, saying that he's in kind of the lower tier of title challengers. And I got to disagree. I'll be honest. Like, he had Usman in real trouble in that fight, and he looked great to start off. So the fact that Usman overcame so much adversity, especially at the beginning of that fight, and really rallied for the stoppage, I was super impressed.
You know, I'm going to say kind of what you said in a little bit of a different way. I agree with you that he's underrated. Here's the problem. All this GSP talk is both unfair to GSP and unfair to Kamaru Usman. Kamaru Usman doesn't give an opportunity because there's two discussions to have. Is Kamaru Usman as great of a welterweight as GSP was, or could Kamaru Usman beat GSP? And there are two different conversations, and they probably have two different answers. So the thing that I like about Kamaru Usman's development and why I think he's underrated is because he can win a fight a lot of different ways. And that became what ultimately made George St. Pierre the GOAT. It wasn't like when Gilbert Burns had him rocked that he immediately went to the wrestling. It was there, but he found other ways out. And the biggest compliment you can give a fighter, which is the John Jones compliment, which is probably why John Jones is the greatest of all time, is he can win his fight and he can win your fight. If you want to fight your way, he'll beat you your way. And if you want to fight his way, he'll beat you his way. And that's kind of where Kamaru Usman is going. And there's only a handful of guys that can do that. And, you know, not for nothing, they're the guys that we talk about, right? Like, when we say that Chael Sonnen lost to Anderson Silva, it isn't just that he lost to him in that first fight. It's that he beat him for 4.5 rounds and Anderson still found a victory. Same thing with Demetrius Johnson. Same thing with, it's Jones, it's Johnson, it's Silva. These guys can win their fight and they can win your fight. Stipe Miocic has a little bit of that to him. Israel Adesanya is starting to get a little bit of that to him. That's what makes these guys great. And I think to not give Kamaru Usman those flowers and say that he can do that, and to immediately say that because he's won as many consecutive welterweight fights as GSP has, that somehow puts them on the same plane. Listen, all GSPs were title shots, guys, title fights. I hate to break it to you. It's not the same. But at the same time, I don't want to take away from Kamaru Usman by saying he's not quite to where GSP is yet. You know, that's unfair too. So for me, I agree with you. I think he's underrated, but I think that, you know, we need to look at him for who he is now and then save the historical perspective for a little bit. You know, I know that's how you promote fights. I get that's why the UFC does it. But, you know, I really think that While I don't know if he could beat Khabib Nurmagomedov at 170 pounds, I do think he might, if Khabib came up to 170, I do think he might be a more diverse fighter. And I think
I agree.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. And here's the other thing about Usman too. Everyone wants to be champ. And that's the rage. To become the GOAT, you have to be champ. He's one of the few champions right now who he's kind of in the perfect division. Like, he's a big welterweight, don't get me wrong. But he's already said he doesn't want to fight Israel Adesanya at 185 because of their relationship that they have. And let's be honest, if he moves up to 185 and fights Robert Whittaker for the title, they're carrying him out like they did Curtis Blaydes. Like, that's just a terrible fight for him stylistically. So for him, I do think he's going to have to be one of those guys like a Demetrius Johnson who we're going to see Usman have to defend his title 8, 9, 10, maybe even 11 times for him to finally really get his dues at 170.
Yeah, I agree. And I it's weird because I'm with him. I like the way that he's handling his career, but he does say some things that kind of, you know, don't reconcile with other things. Like he said, he doesn't want to fight Khabib because of the relationship they have. Well, he just fought Gilbert Burns. He says he doesn't want to fight Israel Adesanya for the same reason. Right. And listen, the one thing I respect about him is, and he's never said this publicly, but I kind of have a little bit of an insight into his beliefs. And I really think that he's like, listen, part of the reason, like, nobody believed the reason why John Jones didn't want to fight Anderson Silva. I believed it. The reason why he didn't want to fight Anderson Silva was because he knew he was better than Anderson Silva, and he didn't want to do that to an idol of his. I think the reason why Usman doesn't want to fight Israel Adesanya is because he goes, listen, we represent this Nigerian contingent, right? And if we're all champions, there's something to that. What good is it if I take one guy out of that equation? And I respect him for that. I've never heard him say it publicly. It's just me projecting that onto him, but that's what I think. All right, let's move on. Daniel Cormier, a former champ, said he thinks Alexa Grasso is the best boxer in women's MMA. Matt, do you agree?
No. Okay. I can understand why he would say that, just because the discrepancy between the boxing skills of Alexa Grasso and Macy Barber were very apparent just from the beginning of that fight. And really, just to contrast this with the main event that we had last night, of course, Derek Lewis and Curtis Blaydes, that fight really cemented the idea in my mind that, okay, the more skilled fighter is always going to win. I'm done predicting the fighter who just has more power. And then, of course, Curtis Blaydes decides, hey, even though I'm way more skilled and Derek Lewis just has more power, Derek Lewis can probably win this one. Grasso looked great, I thought. I really thought that she was doing a great job of just getting from point A to point B a lot faster than Macy Barber. We talked about it a lot on the show. What lands faster, a straight or a hook? Well, a straight always does. And when Macy Barber's throwing those big, long Vanderlei Silva-esque pride hooks, she was just coming up empty every single time. And Grasso was doing a great job of, I'm going to stand in the pocket, I'll land my one, two, maybe three shots, and then I'm going to get out of the way. And just the frustration of Macy Barber as that fight progressed, you could just tell, because it wasn't like she was making adjustments and reads and the fight was getting better for her. She was just kind of getting worse at everything. Her misses became a little bit worse, and you hate to see it. The image that always comes out to me with a fighter doing this, it's in a positive light, I guess, is when Calvin Kattar knocked out Jeremy Stephens with that elbow. When he drops him with the elbow, the follow-up shot that he goes for is this massive left hook. He misses it because Jeremy Stephens is following down, but you just see how out of position he gets himself going for that one big knockout shot. That's exactly what I thought of with Macy Barber. She knew that she was down, and you do like that she's going for that knockout, but she was just throwing so much behind all of her shots, and at that point, she was behind by too much, and it sucks because she was such a hyped-up prospect. But the thing is, not that she's got the Ronda Rousey effect by any means, but she's too well known to just be given some random opponent at this point. Like, there's a reason she was fighting Alexa Grasso last weekend, and she wasn't fighting just another fighter. She was quite hyped up. She was making her return, so they have to give her someone else who has a little bit of hype behind them. Alexa Grasso, although not one of the top-tier draws by any means, she's been the co-main event before. She is a somewhat popular fighter. So for Macy Barber, I don't know if she just needs more time off. I don't really know what the answer for her is moving forward.
Yeah, I don't know either. And I think that my problem with some of the – well, let me just answer the question quickly and just say no. She's not one of the best boxer women's MMA because – and I tweeted this. Amanda Serrano is in women's MMA. She fights for Combate Americas. Holly Holm is in women's MMA, and they're former boxers. So it's insulting to the two of them to say that Alexa Grasso is better. Not that you couldn't be an MMA fighter. I mean, if you're going to interrupt, you might as well.
What about Aline Aldana? Like, is it a y'all must have forgot moment in the bantamweight division too? I mean, that's just tricky.
Y'all must have forgot, like Craig and the mute button.
Yes.
Right, yeah. You're like the Kramer of this show.
I'll go back to producing.
Well, I appreciate
all right.
that. All right. So, listen, I think that, you know, those two, obviously Aldana, like Craig said. But, you know, I think that for me, here's my problem with the Alexa Grasso talk now. Is like, when you tell me that, you know, she's the best women's boxer, when you tell me that she might be Mexico's Ronda Rousey, listen, Let her develop. She doesn't need to have that stuff laid onto her. Maybe she can handle it. Some people are ready for it. Ronda was ready for her moment. You know, she wasn't ready to lose, but she was ready to be great and handle all that. I think that they need to pump the brakes a little bit with Alexa Grasso and just let her develop. All right, let's move on. Kelvin Gastelum picked up a win over Ian Heinisch. Looked good. What do you think his ceiling is at this point?
I'm actually going to flip that around. What do you think Ian Heinisch's ceiling is at this point? Because for Gastelum, no matter what, I think Kelvin Gastelum can give a tough fight to anyone in the top five. I just think his hand speed, his durability, his cardio, no matter what your skill set is, he is going to offer you a difficult look. Because let's say your game plan is you're a pure wrestler. Well, he's a good enough defensive wrestler that he will force you to at least get into a few exchanges on the feet with him. And we saw what happened. Just go back to the Tim Kennedy fight. I understand Tim Kennedy was a little bit older in his career, but still, Tim Kennedy, a much bigger fighter than Kelvin Gastelum, he was able to kind of grind on him for that first round, but Gastelum just stayed composed, was able to get to the feet, and every second that fight was on the feet, he was lighting him on fire. This fight was weird because Ian Heinisch, I guess really that's the story of his UFC career. All of his fights have a really, really strange component to them, and this one he was throwing flying knees but getting out-wrestled by the boxer, even though Ian Heinisch himself likes to wrestle. Like, it was just an odd fight, and for Heinisch, I don't really know where his skill set puts him in the top 10, like, or even the top 15. I know Gastelum will give anyone a tough fight. Yes, sometimes he might get out of there quick, like the Hermanson fight, but I really do think that was more of an abnormality than any of his other fights in his career. But for Heinisch, so I know he can beat Shoeface, and I know that you lose to Kelvin Gastelum and like the Derek Brunsons of the world. That's a pretty wide margin to me.
Yeah, you know, so with Gastelum, here's my thing. And I would love to talk to a sports psychologist about this, because Kelvin Gastelum fights the level of his competition. And you see these guys over time. It has to be a mental hurdle, because if you can do that well against Israel Adesanya, then you should be mugging everybody else. So I think that he's a promoter's dream in the sense that he's not someone who is ever going to be your champion. And maybe you don't even want him as your champion, because he isn't that appealing as a champion necessarily. He's not overly marketable. He's not like a super great looking guy. He's not ripped up. But he's like an ultimate gatekeeper, because anytime somebody's coming up and you want to see what they got, Kelvin Gastelum will let you know what they got. So I think that that's sort of his destiny. He could be like a Johnny Hendricks, where, like, you know, he finds the title, or like a Robbie Lawler, where he's giving guys good fights for years and years and years, and then he just finds the title because he has one great night when usually he just has a bunch of good nights. So, you know, I wouldn't be that surprised to ever see a belt wrapped around his waist, especially if Adesanya stays out of 85. But I don't, like, if I had to bet my house that he was going to be a champion, I would say I think he's just meant to be a top five gatekeeper, I think, is his ceiling. Ricky Simone, great wrestler. Do you think that his wrestling stunts his striking growth? Do you think he's one of these guys whose wrestling stunts their striking growth from the perspective of, instead of learning good technique, and listen, we're going to have a conversation with this today about what really is good MMA boxing and what's good boxing in general, because my number one pet peeve when it comes to MMA boxing is this. When you get in trouble, do you go to your wrestling or do you retreat in a straight line? Because if you retreat in a straight line and sort of do that thing where you just pull your head back, then you're not a solid boxer. You need to, if you get yourself out of trouble with angles, footwork, and head movement, then I can trust your boxing. But if you either go to your wrestling or retreat in a straight line, I don't trust you. So that's my question is, do you think that because he's so solid as a wrestler, it's stunning his striking growth, or do you think he just has an overall ceiling and he'll never be a top 10 guy?
I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. And I do think it's his overall game. When I look at Ricky Simone, he's kind of Cody Stamen 2.0. I just think Cody Stamen's a slightly better wrestler. Like Jimmy Rivera, Cody Stamen, Ricky Simone, they're all just kind of the same fighter at different points of their game. Like Jimmy Rivera, of course, has decent striking. I know when you look at his overall record, there's not a lot of TKO or KOs on there, but Jimmy Rivera is a good striker. It just so happens that he uses his wrestling, he kind of used it both ways. So he used it offensively and defensively. Really likes to keep his opponents guessing. Whereas Ricky Simone, he just goes out there and shoots double legs. And same thing with Cody Stamen. That will be able to beat those guys like Brian Kelleher, those kind of guys, the outliers of the top 15. But Ricky Simone one day is going to have to fight like an Aljamain Sterling or a Cody Stamen or even a Rob Font, who can defend takedowns. And I guess he already fought him. We saw that happen. So for Ricky Simone, I just think his style overall has a certain ceiling to it. Like, I don't ever see him surpassing what Jimmy Rivera was able to accomplish in that division.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's a balance, right? Like, there's a you kind of walk the line of, like, because listen, I think that Kamaru Usman has turned himself into a solid enough striker. He doesn't resort to his wrestling, but it almost put him on his ass in the first round against Burns. So he has so much faith in his chin and so much faith in his striking, when maybe it would have been a good time to say, let's turn this into a grappling match. I mean, again, the history between those two, we'll never know if Usman really feels that confident on the floor with Burns. But again, there's that balance where you got to know when is the time to go to it. When I just don't like guys that immediately get a little bit of into a little bit of a firefight and start diving on legs. All right. Will Julian Marquez ever do anything bigger in the cage than the Miley Cyrus thing was outside the cage? And side note, how do you feel about how he handled that? Because he's catching a lot of shade.
I mean, shoot your shot, you know, like that Steph Curry meme of him shooting the ball and it's like, hey, going into the hoop. Like, he tried, shoot or shoot. If Michael Jordan taught us anything, it's that you miss everyone you don't take. But like, the tattoo thing was kind of weird. I haven't really followed it that much, to be completely honest. I understand he's doing something with the Barstool Fund. So, I mean, that's good if something charitable comes from this. But I got to be honest, Julian Marquez disappoints me even when he wins fights at this point. Him coming off the Contender Series, like, I had high hopes for him. And I remember the card when he fought Darren Stewart. It was on the prelims of RDA versus Robbie Lawler, a classic fight in Canada, in Winnipeg. And it was a good fight, but I like Darren Stewart a lot. He's a fun fighter. I wouldn't necessarily say he is a great fighter. And Julian Marquez had a tough fight with Darren Stewart. And really, ever since then, like Chael Sonnen says, you don't get better by not doing something. And Julian Marquez has not been able to be very consistent ever since he did join the UFC. Because you got to remember, Contender Series started all the way back in 2017. Like, it's been a while since Julian Marquez has been on the UFC roster. And the fact that he's still having back and forth fights with guys like Macky Patolo, that, let's be honest, if he didn't get that submission, he's probably losing that fight 2-1. So it's just, he hasn't progressed nearly as well as I thought he would. And no, I doubt he's ever going to do anything in the cage nearly as impactful as that Miley Cyrus call it was outside of it.
You know, I think sometimes you got to be who you are, right? And I don't hate, you know, the whole her saying shave my. So basically, the way it was he said he liked her, and she said shave MC into your chest hair, and you might have a shot. And then he said for her to do something. I can't remember what he said for her to do. And everybody was like, "Listen, that's not the play." I think if you're Julian Marquez, listen, let's be honest, you're not going to hook up with Miley Cyrus. I mean, that's
probably out of your league,
right? She's definitely out of your league. So you got to play it. You got to maintain your brand if you're not going to get her anyway. Why, you know, I'm old enough that this word coming out of my mouth is going to seem awkward, but you can't be simping for Miley Cyrus if you're not going to get her anyway. If you're going to simp, at least simp for somebody you're going to get. All right, so who do you think won the night?
Bilal Muhammad, oddly enough, because Bilal Muhammad's now fighting Leon Edwards. And here's the thing. I'm a big Bilal Muhammad fan, and I just like his fighting style. And again, he's one of those guys who, does he have all the finishes in the world? No, not by any means. Is he just a really well-rounded fighter who can offer you a ton of different looks? Yeah, he is. And he is another one of those guys like Usman. And I'm not going to say his striking has progressed to the level of Usman's by any means, but Bilal Muhammad's striking has gotten a lot better. And he was one of those guys who, when you got into an exchange with him, he was looking to put you on your butt pretty quick with a double leg. And now he does get hit a little bit too much, and I'm sure Leon Edwards will probably make him pay for it. But the fact that he went from fighting Diego Lima last week to fighting Leon Edwards in the main event in only 2 or 3 weeks in the future, like, that's a massive step up in competition and a massive opportunity for Kamaru Usman. He fought on the main card of a pay-per-view that might have sold 200,000 pay-per-view buys. Like, his profile doesn't get raised that much more. But for Bilal Muhammad, he fought on the prelims. Viewers are normally pretty high on that. That's normally around the millions. He normally has a good interview afterwards, and I'm fairly certain he did. And now he's getting a main event in a fight that he would not have had the opportunity to get if Khamzat Chimaev wasn't ready for it. Like, he gets to skip the Michael Chiesas of the world. He gets to skip the Gilbert Burns. Like, there's so many guys in that welterweight queue right now that Bilal Muhammad just gets to jump over just because he put his hand up and said yes. So I really think Bilal Muhammad won the weekend.
Yeah, I agree. And I think retrospectively, I mean, had we done this recap the night after, we would have been saying probably Usman or maybe even Julian Marquez. But, you know, I think it's interesting that, you know, we're going to have our opinions on whether, you know, when you hear that Muhammad gets the fight, it's weird because of what the UFC has created in Khamzat Chimaev. It's like, well, it's kind of, so we lose Chimaev and we gain Muhammad. That's not equivalent. Well, actually, it kind of is. Like, you know, Chimaev, no matter what you think of him, no matter who, you know, the fact that he's running through everybody like the Terminator, doesn't mean that his list of victims is that great. So, you know, his strict schedule's a little weak. His performances are obviously great, but I'm with you. I think Muhammad wins the night. And obviously, again, he now is put himself in a position where if he wins that fight, he may next have a fight with Chimaev, or he may, you know what I'm saying? Like, he might take Leon Edwards out of the equation. So, it's definitely a huge opportunity for him. As far as performances of the night go, Usman, Marquez, Anthony Hernandez, who had a great submission, and then Pauliana Viana. All right, let's move on to the matter at hand, Matt, which is UFC Fight Night, or UFC Vegas 19, Blaydes versus Lewis. So I started this whole thing off as big night for heavyweights. So let's start with the two biggest in the main event, Matt, in a division that in a year or two, hear me out on this, in a year or two, might be one of the best divisions in all of MMA. Two of the best fighters in that division hooked up on Saturday night in an old-school clash of styles. The question going in was Lewis's power get to Curtis Blaydes before Curtis Blaydes got to Lewis's legs? And the answer was yes, a resounding yes. The result read Derek Lewis defeating Curtis Blaydes via KO, 126 of round two. Matt, I really want your thoughts on this one, because here we go again with Curtis Blaydes, getting close to what we think might be a title shot, and then he finds the banana peel. What do you think in this one? Is it just – is he overly devoted to the rest? Like, what is it with him?
So, first of all, I think you might have got the little preview wrong. I think Curtis Blaydes' hand did touch Derek Lewis's leg before the actual uppercut landed. So he did have the takedown attempt in there, but it was a weird fight. And for this reason alone, I understand Lewis, he landed that first right hand that he threw that looked to have kind of stunned Blaydes, or it definitely landed hard. You could tell there was a little damage around the eye. But Blaydes' striking actually looked pretty good. Like, he was landing leg kicks. He was working behind the jab. And again, Curtis Blaydes, you don't really want him in that striking mode. But at least while he was in that mode, he looked all right. And he was landing clean shots on Derek Lewis. It just, I was surprised. You would always expect Curtis Blaydes is going to go for a takedown in at least one per round, at a minimum, really. And especially in the first round, you're not going to get a better opportunity to get Derek Lewis down than when you're both fresh. You're both dry. You can shoot that power double. And if you get him down, again, it's not like Blaydes is this hellacious ground and pounder. Again, he has that great finish over Alistair Overeem. But other than that one fight, it's not like Curtis Blaydes is going out there really Khabibing guys. He's much more kind of position-oriented over the damage-oriented. But he telegraphed that one takedown attempt so poorly. Like, that's what really surprised me. I don't know if he was too comfortable with his striking, which made him try to shoot from so far on the outside because the leg kicks were working so well. And again, if you're throwing leg kicks, unless you're Justin Gaethje, you can't really do those from a wrestling-type position where you do have, you know, the chance to get your hand around your opponent. It was a really bad takedown attempt, and it's terrible for Curtis Blaydes because, again, I was talking about the Alexa Grasso-Macy Barber fight where, from now on, I just have to pick the more skilled fighter. Do I just never pick Derek Lewis and have to live with the consequences when he knocks people out? Because at this point, like, what beats Derek Lewis? You have to hope his back gives out. Because other than that, like, when you look back at most of his losses, the Mark Hunt fight, so his back gives out. It's not that big of a deal. He comes back and he looks pretty good. And then the JDS fight. Well, I mean, he tore his ACL during that fight. So he kind of has an excuse for a lot of his bigger losses. Daniel Cormier just absolutely out-wrestled him. That was an embarrassment. Like, that was bad, to be completely fair. That was a bad one. But you look at what he's been able to do. I would be more scared to fight Derek Lewis than I would be to fight Francis Ngannou at this point. And I know that's a bit of a hot take, but at this point in my mind, a bit. Well, hear me out though. They both have knockout power. Like, at a certain point, it's just overkill. If Derek Lewis hits you with a clean shot, you're still going to sleep. Same thing with Francis Ngannou. The difference is Derek Lewis can actually throw punches from both stances. He has a little bit of wrestling. He throws kicks and he's unpredictable with his game plan. And the other great thing about Derek Lewis is he has power late in a fight. Francis Ngannou only knocks people out in the first round. Like, the story with Conor McGregor always was he doesn't have a knockout past the second round. All of his finishes are within the first two rounds. Francis Ngannou, all of his finishes are mainly in the first round, other than the Curtis Blaydes fight, the first one, I guess, which ended in Dr. Stoppage, of course, at the end of the second. Derek Lewis carries his power late. He has takedown defense. He can get back up when he's taken down. Like, at this point, I really do think Derek Lewis is the more dangerous fight for anyone than Francis. I just think Francis has better hand speed, and I'm probably going to get torn apart in the comments for this, but again, Derek Lewis just has such a more He has more variety of his strengths. He's the more well-rounded fighter out of the two. And if Francis has 100 out of punching power, Derek Lewis is a 99. So I'd much rather fight Francis at this point than Derek Lewis.
Yeah, basically the comparison is you're getting hit by a truck that's the same size as a Chevy or a Ford. Right, they're both gonna knock your ass dead. Which what do you want on your chest? A Ford sign or a Chevy sign? So I guess I'm gonna introduce a new term to the podcast here. You might know it. I kind of know it a little bit because I've known it for a while. And apologies to Bill Simmons for the flat out thievery, but market correction. So market correction is there's a guy and a new guy comes along who takes what that guy was and expands upon it. Right. So. The example was that I heard recently was that in Pulp Fiction, Quentin Tarantino wanted to cast Lawrence Fishburne. Lawrence Fishburne didn't want to be in the movie. He cast Samuel Jackson. And then Samuel Jackson went on to have the career that Lawrence Fishburne would have had he taken that movie. So here's the market correction. Is Derek Lewis a championship caliber fighter, or is he just a market correction of Mark Hunt, who was ultimately a market correction of Tank Abbott? Like, is he just one of these guys that just sort of shrugs off your grappling, stands up, and then wants to swing for the fences? Or is he more than that?
Again, I'm going to be riding on this fence because it's a little bit of both. Because here's the thing. Mark Hunt never beat wrestlers. Like, 9 times out of 10 when he fought a grappler, they were just going to take him down and armbar him. And I get it. He knocked out Frank Mir. But Frank Mir was 55 years old by the time they fought. Like, that wasn't really the best version of Frank Mir. With Derek Lewis, like, when he does fight grapplers, he does well, and he does have cardio. Like, Derek Lewis, to me, if he was a video game character, he's just like, he put every attribute into luck and into power, and he's just like, okay, this is me from now on. And that's the thing. I don't really know if that makes you a championship caliber fighter. And I always looked at John Lineker this way. From my idea when John Lineker was in the UFC, it's for Lineker to get to a title shot, he needs to get lucky 3 times. And I've seen John Lineker get lucky enough times to believe that, okay, if he had 3 favorable matchups where you have a fighter who's probably not going to take him down, who will stand in exchange with him, he's probably going to get lucky. And it's the same thing for Derek Lewis. The difference is Derek Lewis is knocking out guys who aren't just standing in front of him and striking with him. Like Marcin Tybura, all he did was take Derek Lewis down, and Lewis was still able to get that knockout punch off. Curtis Blaydes was out striking Derek Lewis, and Lewis, when he finally did have to defend a takedown and land a big shot, he was able to do that. It's just, there's still so many unknowns around Derek Lewis, even at this stage in his career, and he's main evented this many shows, and he's had so many big platforms, and he's fought for a title already. It's just his style. There's so many question marks that surround it. So I guess my answer is maybe. Like, if he fought Stipe, I'm not saying he can't beat him. It's just Stipe's so much more technical. But again, how many times has Derek Lewis fought a more technical guy and still won the fight by knockout?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's luck, and then there's promotional luck, where you kind of say it with a wink in your eye, meaning they're setting me up. They're setting up the pins, and I just got to throw the bowling ball straight. And I think Derek Lewis has a lot of that in his life where it's like they could put me in there with a guy who might sleep on me a little bit, might think he's better, and he kind of – okay, so let's move on to something we introduced last time out, and I want to expand upon and maybe explain a little bit better. So 50 feet, 5,000 feet, 50,000 feet. So basically this is the crux of this, which is is the fighter on his coach's desk, on Sean Shelby's desk, or on Dana White's desk, right? So who's really focused on this fighter's future? Let's start with Derek Lewis. Do you think he's at 50 feet, 5,000 feet, or 50,000 feet?
How far away is Albuquerque from Houston? That's my real question, because I think he's at John Jones's house, honestly. Like, it's so weird, the heavyweight division right now. And for Derek Lewis, it probably is 50,000. He's probably talking to Dana White, because they got to figure out what they're going to do with that logjam at the top of the division. Because I get it, people want to see John Jones in that heavyweight title shot. But the way I think about it is, the UFC only wanted John Jones to be the next title challenger because they thought Curtis Blaydes was going to beat Derek Lewis. And at least John Jones, he guarantees you another big fight with Stipe. Not that Stipe's a massive name by any means, but I would say he's about average of what I imagine a UFC champ is. Like, when Robert Whittaker was champion, it's not that he was extremely famous. He just wasn't, you know, one of the least... He wasn't like a Demetrius Johnson, though, who, like, nobody knew. He was just kind of that middle tier. For Stipe, if he fights John Jones, especially beating DC twice, that's another big fight. I got to be honest. I think Derek Lewis and Stipe is a pretty big fight, though, too. So I really do think the UFC has to make up their mind here and try to figure out what they're going to do with the winner of that Francis Stipe fight. And Derek Lewis right now is definitely first in line. But you've also got to worry about Alexander Volkov now, who I understand he lost to Derek Lewis, but hell, he weighs 20-some pounds more. Like, it's barely even the same guy. And also, we had a Manta Ray tattoo before. That looks, it's not even there anymore. It's actually kind of nice. So for Derek Lewis, yeah, they just really need to figure out that logjam. So he's either at Sean Shelby or Dana White's desk.
I'm with you. And maybe a better way to say it would be, you know, what's the most important text you're going to get? Your coach, Sean Shelby, or Dana? Curtis Blaydes, he's getting texted from his coach, right? I mean.
Oh, yeah. And it's wild for Curtis Blaydes, too, because I don't know. I hate to say change training camp. And I don't mean this as like a long-term solution for him by any means. But I would like to see him maybe do like a Kevin Lee. Just go try out another place. Like, you don't need to completely change and leave Elevation. But maybe give American Top Team a try. Maybe look at AKA. Like, a lot of the guys who were at the top of the heavyweight division are starting to age out. And for the longest time, every gym kind of had their heavyweight. Like, Arlovsky was at Jackson Wink. And, you know, Junior was at American Top Team. And, of course, AKA had their roster. A lot of those guys are aging out, and I'm sure they are a lot more open to get a top tier, I'm not going to call Curtis Blaydes a prospect, but a top tier heavyweight like Curtis Blaydes into their doors. And I really do think if he could just expand his game, and we always said this for Gilbert Burns. Gilbert Burns was going to be a champ once he could put all of his skills together. You knew his striking was good. You knew his jiu-jitsu was good. His wrestling was good. He just had a hard time of blending his martial arts. Curtis Blaydes is in that spot right now. Like, if he did go to a Sanford MMA or an AKA or just wherever, just switch it up for 6 months and see how your game expands. I think Curtis Blaydes can still go on a big run in the future.
Well, I think as long as you stay away from the other heavyweights in your division, you're going to benefit that gym a lot, because what he's bringing to the table is now your wrestling program goes up exponentially
100%.
Just by you being in the building. So, yeah, all right. All right, Matt, let's move on. Yana Kuniskaya and Kaitlyn Vieira came in with fairly impressive resumes. Vieira has a good list of victories, including Sajara Eubanks, Kat Zingano, and Sarah McMahon. Obviously, you know, they are where they were in their careers. And Kuniskaya, you know, she had her title shot with Chris Cyborg. So the thought coming in is that the winner of this fight might be going places, if impressive. They start to shape up their next run for the title. However, impressive is not what we got. The ladies took turns dominating control time, with Kuniskaya being the busier fighter and ultimately getting the nod with a trio of 29-28s from the judges. Tell me why this fight mattered, and did either of them sort of put themselves in any sort of position moving forward?
It's weird. And here's the thing. I won't say I was the conductor of the Kaitlyn Vieira hype train, but I was definitely on board at one point. And not that the Kat Zingano fight really impressed me, but I think I was a victim of, you know, when you disagree with the decision, but the fighter that you think won still won. Like, that was a split decision. I just thought that she had won every round. So in my head, I was like, man, she dominated Kat Zingano. Like, that fight wasn't even close. But you got to remember, Kat Zingano was off for a few years and she was on a losing streak. Like, beating her isn't that impressive in hindsight. And same thing, Sarah McMahon, she beat her by arm triangle choke. That's how you beat Sarah McMahon. Like, she's really good at getting other people into arm triangle chokes and then all of a sudden getting put into one herself. So for Kaitlyn Vieira, in my head, I was always like, she's elite, she's elite, she's elite. And then she finally fought Irina Aldana, who, again, Craig likes that she is one of the better boxers in women's MMA, don't get me wrong. But you get knocked out by her, and then you beat Sajara Eubanks. None of that really tells me if you're elite or not. Like, it's a decent resume up until that point, but there's such a large discrepancy between your wins and your losses that I just don't really know where she belonged. And now that she did finally lose to Yana Kunitskaya, who's a fighter that I hate to say she's the new Lena Landsberg, but I don't really ever see her getting to some crazy peak. Like, Yana Kunitskaya is a fun fighter. I think a lot of us know her because of that UFC debut against Chris Cyborg and just how memorable that was for all the wrong reasons. But the only good thing that came out of this fight is that finally the judges scored a fight based on damage and not based on control. And I really like that. Like, that's what they should be emphasizing this whole time. I really like the fact that Yana Kuniskaya put more damage on Kaitlyn Vieira. And I know Craig disagrees.
I want to question you guys as I sit here in the background. But the question is, and I know this is one that came up on Twitter, the whole fight, it came up in the DMs at Fight Name Picks over on Instagram, was a fact of how did you score this fight? Because when you compared this with the Imavov and Haas fight, it was pretty much a carbon copy of the fight that we already had on that card. And the judges decided to totally flip-flop. Now, were they all the same judges? No, they weren't. But you talk about damage. Little rabbit punches scored more than the position for Kaitlyn Vieira. And for Phil Haas in the fight against Imavov, his position really kind of scored more than Imavov's overall striking game and his damage, because he had Phil Haas on wobbly deer legs, made a poor game planning adjustment mid-fight and decided, well, I've got him hurt. I'll just push him up against the fence and maybe get taken down. But I just wanted to get the idea of how you would both score that fight. The one for Vieira and Kunitskaya, because I have a feeling I'm going to disagree with one of you for sure.
Take it away. Okay. So here's the thing. The difference between the Imavov and this fight was Imavov had Phil Haas hurt for minutes in that last round. Like, to me, that third round is a 10-8. For me, I thought Yana Kudelskaya won or lost the first round. Or I thought the first round was close. You'd give it either way. Ketlin won the second round. And the third round, I did think Yana won with that little flurry at the end. I understand Ketlin, she controlled the position for a lot more of that round, but she didn't do anything with it. And I firmly do believe, like, takedowns aren't really worth that much. It's what you do with the takedown. And the fact that Ketlin, she's such a heavily credentialed black belt, and she wasn't really able to get that much going on the ground at any point. Like, I never felt like Yana Kudelskaya was in a whole ton of danger while the fight was on the ground. There was a few iffy positions, don't get me wrong, and it's not like Yana was doing a crazy amount of damage herself until that last little flurry, but I thought Yana did enough to win two of the three rounds. But again, it was really, really close, and not that much did happen to differentiate the two fighters until the flurry at the end of the fight.
Craig's going to hate this answer, and he's going to pop in, I'm sure, and argue with it. But I think the difference for me is that I felt like Haas was being effective in nullifying what Imavov was doing well. Meaning, when there was separation, Imavov was touching him up, right? So Haas then counteracted that. So I feel like he had a more effective use of what he was doing, even if it wasn't I can't stop his effectiveness in striking, so I'm going to close the distance, I'm going to take him down. Whereas I felt like Yana Kunitskaya was just sort of, like Craig said, just, you know, she was in positions and she was just trying to get punches counted.
So the only difference I think between the two is I thought Imavov won the second and the third round. Like, I thought the damage that he had done in the second round was enough to warrant a win in the second round. And I understand he'd only had him hurt for about 20 seconds. But again, Phil Haas did nothing with that cage control. I understand he was neutralizing Imavov striking. But the only damage done throughout that whole fight, Imavov hurt him in the second round. So I thought he won a 10-9 in the second. And I thought the third round could have been a 10-8 for him as well. I thought Imavov won that fight.
I thought Imavov won the fight against Haas. I had him rounds two and rounds three. And in the Vieira fight, I had her winning as well. It came as a big surprise to me. I know we'll talk about it, the MMA decisions and all that. I don't know if you guys go into that. I do edit the show, but that's always an interesting spot to look and see where media members are thinking. And sometimes, you know, it's way totally out of brand. Like, I've seen a couple guys from one major site just kind of go a little off the wall with some of their votes, but that's one of those sites that you should definitely check out, because it's one of those things, like, do you hold judges accountable? I know Chris Lee had a couple of really weird scores on this card, giving a few rounds to fighters that nobody, like, he gave Danny Chavez the first round of his fight, which was a huge surprise. So always interesting to go over there. You get the media member scores, you get the official judges scores, but yeah, for me, I had it for Vieira over Kunitskaya. Again, you see the difference in the strikes, but then you really take it into account, the fact that it was a lot of rabbit punches and Yana doing a good job. You have to keep busy, but overall, very interesting judging and very interesting reffing that night too.
18 media members scored the fight. 14 of them scored it for Vieira. The four that did not were Sean Sheehan, Shaquille Majuri, Dominic Durniot, and Drake Riggs. So not to call, I mean, I'm calling him out. But I'm just saying that was the disparity. The disparity was 14-4 went the way of Vieira. The weird thing about analytics and the weird thing about stats, and again, we always look at these fights in hindsight. We're doing a recap show. I do think that if you did not, in retrospect, right, I think Vieira has a more difficult time explaining that she won. Whereas if you're Kunitskaya, even though she did, I would agree with you. If you're Kunitskaya, you said I had 215 total strikes and I lost the fight. Now that's different than, you know, when Max Holloway has 215 total strikes that you know, Kunitskaya has. So yeah, I think it's always going to be this battle of which do you score more? Do you score, you know, position or do you score damage? If so, what's a lot of damage? How much, you know, effective, what is effective striking? What, you know, if you look at this, it says 47 of her strikes are significant of 215. So yeah, it's a lot of what Craig talked about. So I agree. So now let's move on to where we're at with them though, because obviously Kunitskaya. She's got the high profile relationship she's in. So there's some promotion capabilities there. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's a more promotable of the two for obvious reasons. So 55,000, 50,000. If you're Vieira, because this is interesting for me, because a lot of people felt like you won the fight, but you didn't. So what do you do with that back at your gym? So where do you think both these girls fall in that respect?
So for Vieira, I do think it's one of those 5,000 feet things. Because again, do you think that style that she employed last night against Yana Kunitskaya beats anyone in the top 10? Like, I'm just going to go try to lay on you for some takedowns. Like, I think she'll get wins. Don't get me wrong. But the way I look at the women's division, and I could be wrong with this, but there's three women that are so far ahead of everyone else at 135, it's not even close. You have Amanda Nunes at the top, who's arguably just the greatest fighter of all time. And then you have Jermaine Duranemi and Holly Holm. Those three beat everybody. I don't care who you bring me. It can be Aspen Ladd. It can be whoever. Yana Kunitskaya. Those three women are going to beat anyone else who you bring to them. So for Caitlin, I really do think she has to go back to the drawing board a little bit. And I don't really know who she fights after this, because she has fought some decent competition up until this point. She fought some of the bigger names in the division. But I really do think for her, she has to switch up her mindset, because it's the same thing on the feet. She's always a little too confident with her boxing. And on the ground, she's not urgent enough with her jiu-jitsu, where she is a really good grappler. And I've always felt like her hands needed more development, even though she comes in like, oh, I'm a boxer. I want to go out here and really strike for this. So I really do think she needs just to overall switch up her game plan a little bit.
You know, you talk about when you lose, what do you take from it, right? And Chael talked about this before the Conor Poirier fight. Do you accept that you were beaten? And if you accept that you were beaten, then what's the takeaway from that? I think if you're Caitlin Vieira and you're pointing at all those MMA judges, and you're going on their shows, and they're all telling, or all those MMA media members, and you're going on their shows, and they're all telling you that you won, that's one approach. Or what you could do is you could say, here's a fight I should have won that I lost because I got outworked. And maybe I was winning the positional battle, but this girl put 215 strikes on me, however insignificant, without me getting a better position and putting myself in a position to put strikes on her. And like you said, if I don't have the urgency on the feet and I don't have the urgency on the floor, this is how these fights get taken away from me. I'm leaving it too ambiguous for the judges. So there's something definitely there, I think, for her to take away from it. If she just plays the I should have won that fight game, she won't take what needs to be taken from it. All right, Matt, let's move on. Derek Minner and Charles Rosa are names that are on the top. They're on the tip of most MMA fans' tongues, even at 145 pounds. We knew what this fight was going in. It was, let's see if the kid Minner, he's 30, can handle being in there with a vet who's seen some of the best fighters at 145 pounds. Now, Minner's fought a lot of guys, got a lot of finishes, but I mean, he looked really, really good last night. On the feet, on the floor, it was just his fight throughout. So here's my question for you. Is this a case of he's been hiding in plain sight and he's been this fighter forever and we just now kind of saw it? Maybe I just kind of saw it last night. Or is he starting to make this ascension and Charles Rosa was just the spotlight for that?
Here's the weird thing. Charles Rosa, it's always, oh, he's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. I've seen him out grappled too many times for that to be the first thing that you mention about him. You know, like, I get it. He is good off his back. He's got that fun karate style. He is a good grappler. But you look at the Bryce Mitchell fight, and I understand Bryce Mitchell is one of the better grapplers in that division. But Bryce Mitchell absolutely dominated him completely in every position on the ground. Then you look at this fight, and Derek Minner, again, he's a very good grappler, and he's a better wrestler than Charles Rosa. But that fight, Charles Rosa didn't even have a moment on the ground where I thought he was going to put Minner in any danger. And Minner, on the feet, he looked better. He was able to crack Charles Rosa. It was weird, too, because with Rosa, he's normally got really good movement because of that good footwork and that good distance management that he uses with his karate stance. But it seemed like Minner would just throw, like, wild overhand rights, and they just seemed to land. And it wasn't that his technique was all that good. I don't think Derek Minner's one of the more accurate guys you're going to find at 145. They just, everything he threw seemed to land. And for Charles Rosa, I hate to use this term, but I'm getting very close to it. You look at his last four fights. So you go back. He loses to Shane Burgos. Let's go back five. You lose by TKO to Shane Burgos. No shame in that. One of the best fighters in the world. You beat Manny Bermudez, a guy who can't make weight, even at lightweight. And you beat him by submission. Manny Bermudez did not have a good run in the UFC. And then he loses to Bryce Mitchell, completely gets out grappled, barely beats Kevin Aguilar, and then loses to Derek Minner. Like, I think this is a lot of Charles Rosa might not be as good as a lot of people give him credit for, and less of Derek Minner's the next big thing at 145.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think that thinking that Rosa was going to be the challenge. I mean, listen, if Rosa's the test, the men are certainly passed it. The question is, how hard was the test? You know, was it the final, or was it the midterm, or was it like, you know, something earlier in the year? It definitely wasn't the final. It may have been barely the midterm. So I like this kid. I think that if we're talking 55,000, 50,000, I think Sean Shelby and Mick Maynard are calling him on Monday. You know, I mean, I think
100%.
He's definitely someone that they're circling in their, you know, planner, like, hey, we got to call Maynard.
Now, do you think he could get that, like, Gavin Tucker chance where it's like, okay, you go from you're fighting regular guys and then, oh, you're fighting Cub Swanson. Like, he's not just going to fight a regular guy at 145. Do you think Derek Maynard will get that kind of veteran treatment in the near future?
I think Maynard is at the point now in his career where you put him in there to see who goes forward. This young kid, he's too old to be a prospect, but I mean, we throw that word. The meaning of that word comes and goes. But I think, do you put him in there and say, okay, how much does this guy have left? The guy he's fighting? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that next for him is that high profile, because, you know, we talk about this when guys are making moves on championships in the past of the checklist. You know, you got to fight the guy we thought you'd lose to. You got to fight the high profile co-main event. The high profile main event that's three rounds, and then the five round fight. You know, you gotta check all these boxes. The next box for Minner is, can you fight a big name guy in a big name in a high profile spot? He was on the main card, so he's sort of moving up the card. So his visibility is raising. But next, we gotta see, can he fight that fight where it's like, okay, the nerves are up. You know, can we make sure his next fight is the biggest fight he's ever had, and how will he deliver? And I think because if he fights another guy that's of Charles Rosa's cut from that same cloth, I don't think we get to see how does he handle the butterflies, how does he handle the stage. You know, maybe you move him up one spot on the card and give him a name. All right, so we already kind of talked about this one. Let's go to this fight first, Matt. Alexio Linick has seen it all in his long career, but on Saturday night he didn't see much. Christakis came out, shrugged off Olenek's attempts to pull guard, and tossed him a proper ass-whipping inside the first round. I'm trying to keep with my tradition of not making intros longer than fights. The expectation is that Dawkins will have a number next to his name next week. Do you agree with that? And what do you think this young man's ceiling is?
Here's the thing. So Craig is the conductor of the Seal Gone hype train. And listen, I think more likely than not that hype train might be coming to an end this coming weekend. But I really think Chris Daukaus and also Tom Aspinall, who we saw on this card, both have long careers in the top 10 ahead of them. Like, Chris Daukaus, here's the thing. We've only really seen his striking in the UFC. That's not even what he's best at. Like, he's a better grappler than he is a striker, and he's got three first-round TKO victories, and now he has one over Alexio Linick. And you can say what you want. Alexio Linick's a little bit older in his career. He is a 40-something-year-old man who's had 75 fights. But you have to remember, going into last night, Derek Lewis himself was only coming off a win over Alexio Linick, and we still held Derek Lewis in pretty high regard going into a fight against Curtis Blaydes. So Chris Daukaus, yes, he fought an older guy, but he still looked really good, and I agree 100% with what you said. He did get into kind of some weird positions when Olenek tried to pull guard. He did have in that weird sort of Kimura grip where he was trying to take his back almost while they were standing. It was really odd. But Chris Daukaus stayed composed, stayed calm, was able to finish him on the feet. And Chris Daukaus, here's the thing I like about him. He's an undersized heavyweight, very similar to Tom Aspinall. But again, he is so good on the ground, and it's a wrinkle of his game we haven't even got to see yet. So I'm really high on Chris Daukaus. I really do think the sky is the limit for him, and I agree with you. I do think, and kind of what you had mentioned at the start of the show, and I'm assuming he's part of the reason why, heavyweight's got a very bright future. There are guys out there like Chris Daukaus, like Tom Aspinall, who are going to give those older veterans, they're going to get them out of there really fast, first of all. But they're going to be your new breed, and they're going to be around for a very, very long time. So yeah, I think Chris Daukaus has a super bright future in the UFC.
Yeah, and Daukaus is a kid he's 31, so he's been fighting since 2013. And heavyweights,
he has three kids, and he's a police officer. He's not a kid.
He's a kid to me. I'm 43, and I have two kids. So when I was his age, he could barely drink. So listen, here's what I like about him. I like these guys that have, like, layers, right? Like, we found out as his career went along that Stipe Miocic had layers, right? And there's some of them are personality layers, and some of them are skill set layers, right? So he's a firefighter. So he's got this other thing to him that sort of gives him a little bit of extra toughness. He's a former baseball player. He's got a wrestling background. Like he's from Ohio. Like certain things. Not that everybody from Ohio
can't understand what he says half the time.
You can't understand. He mumbles. You know. I mean, there's certain things. There's certain things that give guys layers, right? Dawkins has layers, right? You're telling me he's a good grappler. He's a Philly police officer, right? Which means he's probably seen some shit. So he's, you know, there's just these things where they start to stack him up, and you're like, okay, he's more than just a guy that's always trained MMA, been in his gym, and his dad trained him, and like, you know, not there's anything wrong with that, but you start to build these different layers to him. And I think that I'm really interested in this kid. I think that he's, I'll say this. I think that Shelby and Maynard are definitely going to be the ones that are reaching out to him come, you know, today, Monday, whenever. But I do think that Dana should give him a great fight kid text. So he's that much on Dana's radar where Dana needs to start to establish a relationship with the kid.
Now, and do you see like a co-main event in his future? Like, I'm assuming he gets his face on a poster in his next fight. And I doubt it's the main event, but I do think he's got, like, a co-main event in his future. Maybe not on a pay-per-view by any means, but he does have, like, a fight night co-main event type against maybe, like, I don't know, maybe not Curtis Blaydes, but another one of those heavyweights who might be aging out a little bit. Like, I do see him getting that level of a push in his next fight.
I'm going to answer this in a weird way. I think that he is better on the mic than Aspinall is, right? Like, he has some personality. But, dude, I'm looking at this guy's Tapology. I saw him last night. He looks like he fought in the early 2000s. I mean, he's got an old-school look. He's not someone – he's got old tattoos. Like, he's not someone that has, like, that it factor. But I could see – yeah, I definitely think – I'm going to ask you an interesting question after we talk about Aspinall. But when it comes to him and Dawkins. But, yeah, I do think that – I think it's time to put Dawkins in there with the fighter, and Alexei Oleinik is not it. But I do think it's time to put Dawkins in there with the guy who, after the fight, Dawkins is a massively more famous fighter.
Like Overeem.
Junior. I don't know if that's Overeem. Obviously, Aspinall just got Arlovski, so you wouldn't give Dawkins Arlovski. But you put him in there with the guy that makes him a more famous fighter, and the casuals say, oh, he knocked out Arlovski, or he knocked out, or whatever. I think now is the time for that guy. All right. Let's move on to the aforementioned Phil Hawes, Nassourdine Imavov. We touched on a lot of this. I'll give you the intro that I wrote, which will have obviously a different meaning now that we've talked about the fight. But Phil Hawes was feeling real good about himself coming into Saturday's fight with Nassourdine Imavov. He is coming off a huge knockout victory and has some of the best wrestling in his division. And on this night, he needed it. Imavov was having none of it in the stand-up with beautiful counter left hooks. And it was Hawes wrestling that saved what would have been a nice view of the ceiling for him potentially. Matt, we talked about a lot about this fight earlier, so I'm going to ask you this very direct question about Phil Hawes. He thinks that he belongs in the upper echelon at 185 pounds. Do you think he belongs in the upper echelon at 185 pounds?
Is that a trick question? No, of course not. Phil Hawes... I look at Phil Hawes like middleweight's Dwight Grant. And I know you're not a big prelim guy, so maybe you know who Dwight Grant is. Maybe you don't.
I've heard of him.
Dwight Grant's the type of fighter who, if he catches you straight on the chin, you're going to go to sleep. And he's always going to have that chance. And sometimes he will fight to the level of his competition in a positive way, and you'll really get impressed by his performance, be it win, lose, or draw. And other times, he's going to go out there and just put on really boring fights. And with Dwight Grant, he came into the UFC, fights Carlos Pedersoli, who is a decent fighter, but he has a super great highlight reel knockout win over him in his first fight. And then his second fight has one of the worst fights of all time against Alan Joban. For Phil Hawes, kind of a similar path. Like, you have this really spectacular win over Malkoon in your last fight, and then commit against Imavov, and every single time Imavov had space, and it wasn't just like, this isn't even an over-exaggeration, like, if Imavov had a foot of distance between the two of their chests, he was hurting Phil Hawes. Like,
yeah.
Phil Hawes got cracked with everything, and they were even just like, I say glancing elbows in the clinch, trust me, I'm sure they hurt, don't get me wrong, but he was getting hit by shots that other fighters seem to get hit with, and, you know, it's just part of a fight, but Phil Hawes getting consistently rocked over and over and over again, and I don't think a smothering clinch game really gets you to the top of the middleweight division, especially not in the year 2021, so I do agree with you. I think Phil Hawes himself thinks that he's ready for those top guys at 185. He's ready for the Uriah Halls and the Chris Weidmans, but after what I saw last night, he definitely is not.
Well, so listen, I'll give a personal anecdote here, not about fighting, but about life, which is to say this. When you are a procrastinator, which I've been known to be, and you get good at pulling things out towards the deadline, right? You get good at it because you do it all the time, right? But it's not because you're necessarily good or you have some clutch gene or you have some sort of magic in your brain. That it's because
John Franklin, Michael Jordan, cut from the same cloth. Right,
exactly. It's because that's all you have. You only have that time space or that space of time. So you have two choices. You can either fail or you can pull it off. And I think that if Phil Hawes's takeaway from this is that, let me transition. The reason why Anderson Silva beat Chael Sonnen decidedly in the second fight is because of what he took away from the first fight. But I can't go in there with the same game plan and think that I'm going to find the magic again like I did in the first fight. If Phil Hawes looks at this like, I'm just a special guy that even though it's tough, always I'm just a winner. I always pull it out, you know? Yeah, you can look at it that way, and it may even be true, but not at the top of the division. You know, you can't and listen, using Israel Adesanya as the example is bad because he's about to potentially be a champ. I mean, he's an all-timer. But you can't perform like that against Adesanya or the higher-level guys because a guy like Imavov is, although he was slick, and I give him a lot of credit because if I'm Imavov, I take a lot more from this fight than maybe Phil Hawes should because – like you said, every little bit of space, he's pulling Thai plums. He's every little bit, he's trying to find. So he's saying, if I got this much space, I could throw this strike. If I have this much space, he was really being smart about what he could do with what he was given. He could not make himself a better wrestler in the middle of the fight, but he could be very efficient with the space he was given, which is what he did. So I was impressed by that. If you're Hawes and you walk away from this fight saying, well, you know, this one was a little tougher than the last one, but still pulled it out, you are vastly underestimating what you need to do to prepare yourself to be in the top 15, 10, 5 of the middleweight division. Because the higher you get up, and I know this seems like an obvious statement to make, but the higher you get up, the margin for error is a lot smaller. You can get away with that shit with Imavov. You can't get away with it with, you know, Paulo Costa and Robert Whittaker and Israel Adesanya. So if you want to be a great, you have to understand that the margin for error that you're leaving yourself, it's not enough. And you got to tighten that up. And you got to understand that, like, just because you knocked a guy dead early in a fight, that you're a guy who takes people down, ground and pounds, transitions. You can have some success on your feet, but you got to know when you're in there with a guy who's really making good efficiency of the space you're giving him, and you just can't take those kind of risks. And no, in his defense, he did what he should have done given the situation he was in. So I can't give flowers to Imavov for making the efficiency of the space he was given and not give flowers to Hawes for making the best of the fact that he knew he had to shut all of that down to win the fight because he did. He did what he had to do. Right.
Here's the thing for Hawes. You compare him to the Adesanyas and the Whitakers and the Costas. Like, I don't even think he beats the Heinishes of the world. Like, I think he's in there with the Gerald Meerschaerts. I really do. I don't think Phil Hawes is going to be a top 15 guy ever. And that might be harsh for me, but he hasn't shown me anything that says, like, wow, he has such a developed skill set that he can go out and beat. Because I think a top 15 guy, so you have to think, one of the worst guys in the top 15 is Brad Tavares. And look at what Brad Tavares just did to Antonio Carlos Jr., who fights in a manner similar to Phil Hawes. Now, again, Antonio Carlos Jr. is way better at jiu-jitsu and Phil Hawes is more the wrestler, but he just goes out there, tries to be heavy and go for a lot of takedowns. Brad Tavares absolutely beat the brakes off him and that fight wasn't even close. He's your ranked 15th fighter at middleweight. So you have to think that's the difference between Phil Hawes and a guy in the rankings. So I really just don't think Phil Hawes is a guy who's going to be around in the rankings forever. I think he thinks he will be, like you had said, but for me, it's just not there. I got to be honest.
No, I'm with you. And I think that, Tavares would be a good measuring stick for him because Tavares is the kind of guy that if you do that stuff with, he's savvy enough of a wrestler to give himself some space to do damage. And I think that if he was fighting Brad Tavares last night, it might have been a little bit different. Okay, let's move on to perhaps the intro I should have given earlier, which is the heavyweight division, as we spoke about earlier, might be on the verge of a renaissance. An all-time great champion is Stipe Miocic, coming off a career-defining trilogy, a monster of a number one contender who strikes fear in the hearts of all across the cage from him, and arguably the greatest fighter of all time on his way in. Not to mention this week and next week's cards have heavyweight main events. And in all of that, quiet as kept is Tom Aspinall, a 6'5", 235-pound kid, with seemingly all the tools who finishes everybody. On Saturday, he drew former heavyweight champion Andre Arlovsky, and you guessed it, he finished him. It came in the second round when Arlovsky looked kind of had to have his footing a little bit, maybe feeling himself. And Aspinall just said, well, listen, I'm just going to take you down now. And for Christ's sakes, a guy that talented looked like Brock Lesnar, just deciding I'm just going to, you know, I thought, you know, Arlovsky was Heath Herring. And, you know, and Aspinall was Brock Lesnar. He just went after him, got him down. Wasn't the most beautiful choke I ever saw, but it was a huge kid. So it was effective. I want your thoughts on this fight. I want your thoughts on the kid. I got a great question for you that I don't think I've ever asked you in this way before, which I'll get to. But what are your thoughts on Aspinall? How do you look? Do you think Arlovsky is a fair measuring stick at this point?
Arlovsky's weird because this is what he is at this point in his career. Like, he's 30 and 20, but he used to be a champion at one point. Like, champions don't go on to have careers of 30 and 20, you normally don't think, but against the level of competition, he's just fought really high level guys throughout the entirety of his career. And at this point, sometimes he beats prospects who don't have very high output, and sometimes he loses to prospects who have fast hands and can crack his chin. And honestly, to Arlovsky's credit, he did get stunned in the first round, and I thought it was over right there. Like, normally, once you hurt Arlovsky, he never really rallies to come back into a fight. Like, once he does get stunned, he's on his way out. But Aspinall, the thing I really like about him is he is kind of like Jeff Neal with regards to his finishing ability, where he's not just going to hurt you and try to, is not the best way to use this term, but blow his load really quick in the first round. Like, he is going to go out there, he's going to hurt you, he's going to stay disciplined, he's going to work behind his jab, and he's not just going to overexert himself going for the finish. And for Arlovsky, he's kind of been able to get away with just being a really good cardio and footwork heavyweight at this stage of his career. Again, he just sort of move out of the way of most guys' shots and out-volume them to win decisions. But against Aspinall, you see how good his boxing is. His ground game is absolutely absurd. He's a really credentialed black belt. And he's one of the more exciting prospects right now, I'd argue, in all of the UFC. Like, when you put his whole skill set together, the thing that I'm interested in, again, maybe this doesn't even really exist. It's more of a Joe Rogan talking point than anything, but you talk about the squeeze in MMA and how there's black belts and then there's black belts who have the squeeze with their chokes. Maybe Andre Arlovsky was hurt and he was on his way out anyways. Could you imagine if Tom Aspinall has the X factor of the squeeze as well on the ground? Like, you take his stand up with his jiu-jitsu ability and the fact that he can finish guys with chokes that fast on the mat. Like, I'm not saying we have the next, like, Fabricio Verdum with the hands of Tyson Fury by any means, but you can see where this is trending and kind of where his ceiling is looking. And it kind of looks like Tom Aspinall could be a future champ. I see he's going to be in the top five one day on our live chat right before the fights. And I got a little bit of flack for it. So thank God he looked as good as he did. But again, I really do think Tom Aspinall, he's going to be around not only for a long time, he's going to be fighting for a title at one point in his UFC career.
Well, listen, and I'm going to go ahead and copyright this. So none of your other podcasts that listen to us, take our stuff, take this one. He's Benjamin Button, Frank Mir a little bit. Looks like him. He doesn't have the grappling of Frank Mir, but he might have better hands. He looks like, it's crazy to say it because they look, you know, you never want to fall into the trap of these guys look the same, so I'm going to compare them, but I'm going to do it. In that, imagine all the problems that we always have with Frank Mir, right? He's not motivated enough. And in fairness to Frank,
he was in a motorcycle. Severe motorcycle accident, yeah.
Well, yeah, he was in a motorcycle accident. Here's the other thing, is that he fought in an era where Brock Lesnar was in there. So what would have been a 230, you know, a guy who would have looked like Aspinall, to be honest, you know, although Mir's shorter. Mir wanted to be a little more cut up, but you can't go in there with Brock Lesnar and not be 240, 245, 250 pounds. Can't go in there and be 225 because it's not going to work. Can't go in there and be 230 and fight Brock Lesnar when he's at the limit, heavyweight limit. So I think for me, the interesting thing about Aspinall is, like you said, is he able to find that? The thing I like about him is I'm with you. I don't think that he's so he's going to let a first-round finish dictate how he prepares, how he fights, who he is. I do see some Darren Till in him in one very important respect in their teammates. It was weird. Darren Till was this guy who always, when people threw punches at him, he would go away. And it's funny because he called himself a gorilla. He would go away with his hands in the air. And Aspinall does that too, which I'm not quite yet convinced that's a good or bad thing. But I just saw it in the two of them, and it was interesting for me. There's certainly a way it could be a bad thing if someone decides to expose that with a leg kick to the body. But I guess my thing is, here's the question I've been dying to ask you. And it's a spin on something that's been asked a lot stock up, you know, all that kind of stuff with fighters. Who do you think the biggest manager in MMA is? It's got to be Ali, right? Ali Abdelaziz.
Well, he basically runs the PFL, so yes.
Right, but he's dominance guy. Khabib.
Exactly.
Kamaru. He's got one spot in dominance MMA. Does he sign Chris Daukaus or Tom Aspinall?
Tom Aspinall so fast, it's not even funny. Here's the thing. I agree with what you said. Like, Chris Daukaus on the mic is better than Tom Aspinall. Don't get me wrong. And I do think that they – listen, I get
he's pinning his hopes, right? Because Ali's he's living paycheck to paycheck. He's got no way
He's pinning the
future of dominance MMA on Daukaus or Aspinall. You want Aspinall?
Chris Daukaus, it's like he might have more of the Derek Lewis effect where he might be able to get slightly more outside sponsors. But again, you're dealing with Tom Aspinall and Chris Daukaus. I don't expect superstar ceilings out of either guy, but at least with Aspinall, and this is why I think it's more likely for Dana White to be calling him than just Sean Shelby, the UFC loves it when they do have kind of a face of another country. And right now, Darren Till is kind of the face of UK MMA, but not really. Like, Darren Till hasn't won a fight in a minute now. And you remember Darren Till, like, he lost to Whitaker. He had the weird fight with Gastelum where he kind of won, but no one remembers that fight. It's like, oh, wow, Darren Till really went out there and dominated. Tom Aspinall right now has a very developed skill set. He's a small heavyweight, which makes him kind of unique just aesthetically. He doesn't really look like everyone else in the division. And yeah, I really do think that he has a future in the top five, in the top 10. And just regionally, I think he's the more important fighter out of the two.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm kind of not great at doing this anymore. I used to know, but now the media landscape is so different. Like, I would think that Aspinall could go ahead and assume the Michael Bisping position of, like, a great career, gets out, starts to do some work. But I could also see a world where Darren Till is this zany-ass guy on the desk that's talking crazy. And, you know, I'm not 100% sure who I think is the more marketable fighter moving forward to the two of them. But, yeah, I agree with you. Let me just say this. I agree with you that Dana White likes to have the guy that represents all the regions, the guy. And listen, this isn't talked about a lot, but Mark Hunt sort of leads to Robert Whittaker. These guys sort of lead to the next wave of fighters, right? So Dan Hardy and begets Michael Bisping, begets Aspinall, begets all those guys, right? They all – Darren Till – nobody puts posters on walls anymore. But if they did, they all would put somebody's poster on their wall. All right, let's get to the prelims. In the first, Jared Gordon defeated Danny Chavez via unanimous decision. A couple 30-27s and a 29-28. What you got here?
Not a lot to talk about here, honestly. Jared Gordon's in this really weird spot because he did miss weight by 5 pounds. And here's the thing. He's missed weight multiple times at 145. He's done fighting at featherweight. If I'm Jared Gordon's coach, if I'm his manager, hell, if I'm his friend, I don't want him to fight at 145 anymore. When you miss by 5 pounds, you should never be allowed to fight at that weight class again, really, no matter what. It's just such a massive miss. And I understand you got the win, but it was one of those wins, and I think you'll agree with me. There's different categories of wins. Of course, you win by highlight reel KO like Derek Lewis. You can eke out a really close decision like Phil Hawes. Jared Gordon won in a way that suggests the fact that he weighed 5 more pounds helped, if that makes any sense. Like, the way that he won, he grinded Danny Chavez. He used his weight. He used his grappling advantage. It was an okay performance, don't get me wrong. But again, for Jared Gordon, you look at his UFC career, he's the definition of a fighter who beats a lot of guys who are making their UFC debut, and that's about it. And Danny Chavez fighting him, it just reminded me of that. Does Chavez seem like a guy who's going to go on and have a really long UFC career? No, he seems like a guy who we're going to look back at in 5 years when we look at a Tapology about a guy who we remember fondly, and we're like, oh, remember this guy who went like 0-3 in his UFC career? Like, he's kind of got that bit of a feel to him. I'm really going hard on Danny Chavez right now. Yeah, I apologize.
Unnecessarily.
It's rude, too. But for Jared Gordon, again, I know that you're better than Dan Moret and Danny Chavez, and you're worse than Charles Oliveira. That's neat. Like, that's cool. That's a pretty wide margin, though. And I just don't ever really seeing him making his way to the top of the division. He has a great story. But at a certain point, like, that's all people really know Jared Gordon is the fact that the commentary keeps on bringing up the fact that he's got such a great story. And I agree, he does. But at a certain point, the UFC, they're a great example of this. People really only care about what you do in the cage at a certain point. Like, Conor McGregor's a good example. His star power is huge. But if you don't win fights, people are going to stop caring. And Jared Gordon's not even close to even, like, that level of a star. He's only a star to, like, the people who are logging into Twitter every day, like you and I, are looking to try to figure out, you know, the up and coming fights and try to figure out what fighters are tweeting out. Like, the people like us know who Jared Gordon is, but other than that, I don't really see him going on a run at 145 or 155. I hope he stays at 155 in the future. But yeah, there's not really a whole lot to take from that fight, to be completely honest.
John Castaneda defeated Eddie Wineland via TKO, 444 in the very first round. What do you got here?
I was dumb and picked Eddie Wineland because I love WEC guys and I really like Matt Brown. And for some odd reason, Matt Brown, Cub Swanson, and Eddie Wineland are not, they all kind of fight the same way in my head. Joe Rogan likes to use this term where he's like, if this fighter, if you just saw a silhouette of them, you'd know exactly who they were. And he always brings up, you know, like Dominic Cruz, and Eddie Wineland's another guy who he brings up. I disagree. Eddie Wineland and Cub Swanson strike in almost the exact same way. Like, they both hold their hands extremely low. They switch stances, they throw some kicks, but they're primary boxers. It's the exact same thing for both guys. The difference is Eddie Wineland has the chin of Matt Brown now. He is at that stage of his career where he wants to be able to get into those kind of brawls like he used to when he was in his prime. He just can't accept the damage anymore. And it was a perfect example of that. He got off to what I thought was a pretty good start to the fight. He was landing good shots, but as Castaneda started landing the calf kick, you could tell that Wineland is not as fast as he used to be. And when he tried to pull out of one exchange, got clipped clean and was put away pretty soon after. So it was disappointing to watch because you hate to see those, you know, those classic WEC strike force, you know, the pride guys get put away, but it's probably it for Eddie Wineland, which really sucks to say. But for Castaneda, he was given one of those veteran cards. Like, beating a guy like Eddie Wineland, listen, Wineland's not the guy who fought for the UFC title. He's not the guy who had the WEC title, but he is still a decent fighter who fans recognize. So Castaneda got a really big win under his belt.
Yeah, and I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. Like, part of it is, I think if you're going to have a guy on a roster, the question is, what is his purpose, right? And we kind of could have talked about this with Arlovski and Aspinall, which is, you, when you're a fighter like Eddie Wineland, you have to look across the cage and say, am I in here because of him or is he in here because of me? Like, exactly. Who are they really looking to push here? And if they're looking to push him comparatively, then I'm a sacrificial lamb in a lot of ways. So
John Castaneda is your next Andre Ewell. And you're going to pin your hopes and dreams on the fact that Andre Ewell beat Henan Barão and John Castaneda beat Eddie Wineland. So that's who he is. That's pretty much the way that I look at this one.
I got to admit, I like it a little bit because you don't really know when it's coming. You know, it's very Kramer-esque. Yeah. I feel like you and I are like, I'm George Costanza, you're Jerry Seinfeld, and then Kramer pops in. All right, Julian Arosa defeated Nate Landwehr via TKO. 56 seconds of the very first round. What'd you have here?
Okay, I'm just going to tell a quick little story. I hate professional wrestling. I think it's the dumbest thing ever. I used to like it when I was a kid. I'm not going to lie. I was a big Jeff Hardy fan. But at this stage, I just don't get much enjoyment out of it. And I remember I was driving, and I don't listen to a lot of Luke Thomas when he was on SiriusXM, but I have SiriusXM. And I remember his time slot, I think, was like 4 p.m. So you know how sometimes you're going to watch a basketball game, so you kind of have to watch like the last 5 minutes of whatever was on before it. Well, that was the case before the Luke Thomas show. And it was like Busted Open, I'm pretty sure the name of it is. And it's a SiriusXM show based around professional wrestling. And one guy got really over emotional because this troll called in and he said, Ric Flair can't be that good because he's a 17-time world champion. And he can't be that good at something if you lost it 16 times. And I thought it was hilarious. What a great way to troll someone who loves Ric Flair. For Julian Arosa, he's been in the UFC 3 times. That means you've been cut twice from the UFC. That's not a great statistic to be known for. And I thought he did not have a snowball's chance in hell against Nate Landwehr last night. But Nate Landwehr, good on Nate Landwehr. And you know what he loves to do? Like, I love playing one-on-one pickup with my friends. Nate Landwehr loves running face first into knees in a UFC octagon. He just can't avoid it. It's happened to him in 2 of his 3 tenures. And I'm pretty sure the only reason it didn't happen against Darren Elkins is because Darren Elkins is tall enough to get his knee up to Nate Landwehr's head. He's just like, he does the same thing every fight. And we talked about predictability, you know, like Derek Lewis, Curtis Blaydes, was he maybe a little predictable with his takedown attempt? Yes. But Nate Landwehr, it's every single GD fight. I don't really know what you do at this point. Like, it's just his style. And if Julian Arosa is able to TKO you in the first round with a flying knee, everyone in the UFC can. Like, Julian Arosa has been cut from the UFC twice. He has looked good as of late. He had that massive underdog win over Sean Woodson. But again, if you're getting knocked out by him in under a minute, you need to reevaluate a lot in your life.
You know, it's interesting. I would say this. I knew what fight we were talking about, okay? And I pride myself on doing this as well. But if a meteor landed in my backyard right now, I would be less surprised than I was that you brought that anecdote all the way back around to Julian.
Really?
I was so impressed. I was like, how can we possibly get back to Julian Arosa here?
Don't worry.
And goddamn
new
it,
show, full circle with Matt Alley.
There you go. Casey O'Neill defeated Shayna Dobson via TKO, 341 of round number two. What do you got here?
I mean, I guess I'm in this mood now, so just going to continue. Hey, Casey O'Neill, you're a great prospect. You beat a fighter who's now 4-5 in the UFC. There's not a smaller fan of Shayna Dobson than your boy over here. I get it. She's tied with Valentina Shevchenko for the tie and KOs in the division. Like, that's kind of cool. That's a wild stat, first of all. Like, Terrence Ross was the Raptors. He was the leader for points scored in a single game for the Raptors. And you're like, really? Terrence Ross, the bench player for Orlando? But yeah, he went off once. And this is what it kind of feels like for Casey O'Neill. Like, she's a good fighter. With the Valentina. Like, Valentina Shevchenko, wait, who she tied with for knockouts in the division? Shayna Dobson. It doesn't make any sense. And listen, Casey O'Neill looked really good. And it's a decent measuring stick because, again, for O'Neill, we didn't really know how good she was coming into the UFC. She fought a lot of, we're just going to say, subpar talent on her way up. And then you fight a fighter who was exactly 500 on your way in. Not a better way to figure out how good you are. Like, if you lose to a 500 fighter, you probably don't belong. And if you beat a 500 fighter, I guess you don't not belong, to say it in a slightly confusing way. Again, it's a good win for Casey O'Neill, but for Shayna Dobson, we all just know her at this point for that Agapova upset. And that was just an odd fight that I do feel is kind of an outlier in her career. So it's a good win for Casey O'Neill. She gets introduced to the UFC, but again, you beat a fighter who never really should be much in the UFC to begin with.
I don't even know how to follow that. You're on one. Craig, Matt's got vibes. I used to do this recap show 100 years ago. I can't remember the guy I did it with. It wasn't very nice. But we see this thing called Not For Nothing. You're on the Not For Nothing vibe right
I'm
now.
Fired up today.
You are fired up. You're going out with a bang. Eamon Zahabi defeated Draco Rodriguez via KO. 305 of the very first round. What about this one, Matt? What can you possibly say about this one?
Okay, a little behind the scenes then, since I'm on one. So, Craig, we were going to do the predictions today, but we didn't have a good night last night. So Craig was like, let's regroup. And here's the thing. Right before we were going to do question mark kicks, I was like, I'm not going to pick Draco Rodriguez. It's not worth it. Like, Eamon's a hobby. He hasn't showed me anything in the UFC up until this point. But this is going to be one of those performances where he finally is going to look good. And for some odd reason in question mark kicks, normally Craig gives – or I give my prediction first, then Craig gives his. But for some reason, Craig just went, oh, and I have Draco Rodriguez in this. And enough – him saying that was enough for me to go, you know what? Craig's probably right. I'll believe him on this one. And I could not tell you how much I regret that pick. Now, Eamon Zahabi looked really good. And I'll be honest, leading up to this fight, we saw him win his one and only UFC win in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, because we talk about that city probably way too much. But he did look that good even in his one win. And again, he's one of those fighters who you remember him for his lows, not his highs. And that Ricardo Ramos knockout was awful, where he just hit him with that brutal spitting elbow. It looked like he broke his jaw. It was just really hard to watch. It was a great win, though. And Zahabi, just because of his last name, he is going to get slightly more notoriety than just your average UFC fighter. So it was a really good job by him. Also, you always like to see it, too, when a fighter beats their opponent who misses weight by quite a bit. So good win for Zahabi. He finally gets a really nice stoppage win in the UFC. But again, I don't really know where I put his ceiling moving forward. I've seen him last night with such a good showing. But that's the only bright spot really in his UFC career up until this point. So I'm going to need to see him be a little bit more consistent. He has been able to stay in there all that often throughout his UFC career. So hopefully we can see Eamon get in there. Maybe, you know, more than once every 2 years, it would be very nice moving forward.
All right, Matt. So if I can really defend myself here, the fighters that missed weight last night went 1-2. How odd is that? You know, it was a stat in 2019. If you miss weight, you're almost guaranteed to win. Draco Rodriguez weighed in at 140.5 pounds, and he went in there way too cocky, kept his head up like he was trying to walk down Zahabi, but he wasn't throwing any output. And we talked about it in the prediction video. Eamon Zahabi, if you went back, the first fight against Reginaldo Vieira in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, where Mario Yamasaki wanted Derek Lewis to kill Travis Brown, to kill him. But if you went back and watched that fight, Zahabi didn't look all that great. You could see that he could mix it up, and he had a great run in the regional scene. His next time out there, he looked pretty good against the guy that we're talking about here. Like, he looked pretty good against Hamosh. It was on the big pay-per-view UFC, what was it, 217? Yep. He was having some pockets of success. And then he fought, who was it, Vince Morales, Cachero. There's too many Vinces, but he fought one of the Vinces, and he didn't look good. He didn't look very good at all. So you have a huge layoff. You have COVID. Like, I know he didn't really have any symptoms. He was talking about like his mental health with RDS up here in Canada, but it wasn't necessarily his mental health. It was like, I've had to really evaluate my whole psychology behind this or before this fight. Like, it was just a lot of weird stuff going into it versus Draco Rodriguez, who is so insanely wild in his fights that the only time he looked bad was when Tony Gravely out-wrestled him. So it was hard not to pick Draco Rodriguez. He goes in there, and, you know, we talked about my guy Dricus du Plessis, right? Like, Dricus du Plessis, oh, well, he's this awesome prospect. Like, Mateusz Gamrot. Gamrot was gun-shy against Guram Kutateladze. Dricus du Plessis was gun-shy against Marcus Perez. Draco Rodriguez was insanely gun-shy against Ayman Zahabi to the point where Zahabi went, okay, I've downloaded his reads in less than a round. Boop, I'm going to hit him and knock him out completely. Like, Draco Rodriguez looked very, very bad. And now it's to the point where this is a 24-year-old that's now 7-2. Where the hell does he fit in the UFC?
Can I tell you what I think is my favorite part about the pop-ins? Is that,
please
is
do. That
literally, he's the one who edits, who's editing this video. And every time he pops in, it makes it harder to edit the video. That's neither here nor there. Anyway.
So, poor guy.
But hey, listen, that's his cross to bear. All right, Sergey Spivak defeated Jared Bandera via TKO 432 of round number two. Matt, would you have
I like Sergey Spivak. No one else does. Like, I'm his one fan in the world. And I was Marcin Tybura's only fan. Then Craig tried to steal my thunder once. But no, Marcin Tybura is my guy. And Sergey Spivak is too, for better or worse. And listen, he's never going to become champ. He's never going to get in the top five. Hell, he probably won't ever get in the top 10. But could Sergey Spivak give you a pretty fun fight? Yeah, he can. And he is another fighter kind of like a Marcin Tybura or even like a Blagoy Ivanov, where, yes, he's going to want to get in top position. And his bread and butter is getting, you know, taking you down, getting on top, getting that ground and pound, or getting a head and arm choke or whatever submission, really. When he fights guys who do similar things to himself, just go back to when he fought Tybura. Tybura just out-wrestled him, but Sergey Spivak against just an unranked heavyweight, he's probably going to maul the majority of them. Like, go to the Tai Tuivasa fight. That wasn't even close at all. He beat the absolute brakes off him. The second the fight got to the ground, he beat him really bad. The Jared Bandera fight, really, this fight's more memorable for how bad Chris Toyoni was. And we talk about Mario Yamasaki trying to kill people. Chris Toyoni as a bare-knuckle boxer is something that I kind of want in my life, but also something that I don't think any fighter really needs in theirs. Just because, like, he's at the point now where he is at that Yamasaki level where the only reason we really talk about him is because he does have such late finishes. So it's a good win for Spivak. Again, Vandera is not the best opponent by any means, but for Spivak, it's good. At this point, he has only really lost to that upper echelon of fighters. His two losses, of course, coming to Walt Harris and Marcin Tybura, but he does tend to beat every guy who is unranked at 265. So I'll be interested to see where they match him up moving forward, but not a whole lot you can take for that fight other than just how horrible the stoppage was.
All right, Matt, let's hit the wrap. Let's start with some housekeeping notes. Let's talk about these bonuses. The bonus went to Derek Lewis for his knockout victory, went to Chris Daukaus, went to Tom Aspinall, went to Ayman Zahabi. Any problem with any of those bonuses?
Not really, honestly. They're all pretty justified. I don't think I'm good at them all. Again, who did you say? Sorry, I missed one of them. I didn't actually see who got the bonuses last night.
Zahabi, Aspinall, Daukaus, and Lewis.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm perfectly fine with all three of those.
All right, let's go to the victory lap. Where were you right last night? Where did you, what you feel good about?
I was right that I do think Tom Aspinall will be a future top five, and that was pretty much it. Like, my future predictions were all right. It's just my predictions for last night really weren't that great. I thought Derek Lewis had a really okay chance to land an uppercut. I did at least get that right. Still thought Curtis Blaydes was going to win the fight, but all in all, I feel like the analysis was spot on, and just the predictions were not.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take back the crown for 1 week, but truth be told, like, we both had absolute dog shit weeks. Like, you went 5-7, I went 6-6. Like, it's nothing to hang my fucking hat on. Like, we didn't have a good week. You're right. The analysis was on, and what we always try and do with Fight Night Picks, Matt, and this is kind of like, you know, tail between our legs, at least we offer up a path to victory for both fighters. And in the main event, it's pretty cut and dry, right? Curtis Blaydes is going to wrestle or maybe strike. Or if you look at Derek Lewis, he's got one punch knockout power. Yana Kunitskaya is really well-rounded. She's probably going to land some strikes. And Ketlin Vieira has jiu-jitsu and judo in her back pocket. Maybe she'll use that. Charles Rosa, we were split on it. You can go all the way down through the list.
You look like Ted Cruz handing out water right now, doing quality control.
That's the thing, right? Like, so we had terrible, terrible weeks. You know, you got to just kind of regroup and reassess. And the picks will come out a little bit later this week.
I don't know why.
Craig Allen, ladies and gentlemen. Craig Allen.
Right? I don't know why he just doesn't finish out with us. So then with that big said, we'll skip where you went wrong. Let's talk about takeaways. And I think actually we did a pretty good job of talking about takeaways. Is there anything that just sticks out to you? I mean, Aspinall looked good. Dawkins, we talked about those two guys. Lewis.
I don't know what Curtis Blades does next. And I mean this for a few different reasons, if you can let me explain. Curtis Blades is in a Corey Anderson position. I really do think he is, where he's been so outspoken about the fact that, yeah, I'm not going to fight in an exciting way. And I think the UFC, like, that's fine if you win every single fight and if you're in the top five and if you do beat those elite guys. And listen, I'm not here to say Curtis Blades isn't elite just because he can't beat Derek Lewis and Francis Ngannou, who quite possibly could be 1A and 1B for the hardest hitters in UFC history. Like, just because you get knocked out by them does not mean that you are no longer elite. What it does mean, though, is you do have chinks in your armor and you're not unbeatable by any means. And if you are going to be so outspoken about the fact that you're not going out there to put on the most exciting performance, we saw what happened to Elias Theodoro. He went on a massive winning streak, lost one fight to Derek Brunson, who is one of the better middleweights in the world, and the UFC cut him. Like, they just cut him loose. Now, I don't think Curtis Blades is at that level of UFC hate for the UFC just yet, but I don't think the UFC loves Curtis Blades by any means. Like, I definitely think Dana White was fist pumping that Derek Lewis won by such vicious knockout last night. Like, it's so weird too for Blades because he's fought so many of the top guys. He beat Overeem. He beat Volkov. You could run back the Volkov fight maybe because, again, Volkov, he gained so much weight. He has been looking really good as of late. But for Blades, I just don't really know what you do with him in the future. Like, is he your future Bellator heavyweight champion?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad we can agree.
I think Curtis Blades is headed to Cokerville, so much so that if you were to smell Curtis Blades, he would smell like Scott Coker's cologne. That's how much he's headed to Bellator. And I don't think he can't hang in UFC. He just seems like a Bellator guy to me. I mean, Corey Anderson wasn't surprised when he went there. Ryan Bader, the guys that go, it's not really a surprise to me. There's nobody that I see in Bellator, and I'm like, oh, man, I only ever expect to see that guy in the UFC.
Or PFL with the Ali Asaevs and the Jared Rosholtz of the world.
Yeah, so we could just out-wrestle a bunch of other wrestlers.
I think that the PFL would be an interesting choice. Yeah, I'm with that. I'm not totally opposed to that. Let's talk about who won the night. Who do you think won the night?
It's weird because, okay, overall, Derek Lewis probably won the night. And here's the reason why. I had friends who don't care about MMA at all send me that knockout. And that's kind of how I gauge how well or how viral, I guess, someone went. And it's not like Derek Lewis went viral in the way that, like, Max Holloway did when he was doing his no look to Calvin Kattar. Like, that really blew up on the internet. Derek Lewis, though, just how violent that knockout was really is going to stand out to people. But to me, I do think Tom Aspinall's your winner on the night. I just think, if we look at futures and we just kind of project where we thought everyone's ceiling was going to be before last night, and then we kind of reevaluate what it is today, I still do believe Tom Aspinall does have top five in his future. And for Chris Daukaus, I think he will be a ranked guy. I just think if you match them up today, Tom Aspinall is probably going to win that fight. So for me, it's Aspinall, but I think you have an argument for either one of those heavyweights.
Interesting question. Aspinall fights Daukaus. What are they both ranked whenever they fight?
When they fight, that is an interesting question, and I think it matters.
Meaning, I guess the question is this. Does the UFC keep them apart or put them together? Like, are they trying to avoid, you know, some guys just, they don't cross paths for a while because the UFC kind of knows they're the future?
So the most 2014 fight I can ever think of is when the UFC was going to have a main event of Brandon Thatch versus Wonderboy Thompson. And that was going to be a main event because it was like these two bright young contenders. They were rising stars. They were just both really exciting. Of course, Brandon Thatch is such a good striker. I don't know if the UFC wants to do a similar thing in this fight where it is, okay, we have these two really good prospects. Let's let them fight now. Because the good thing about getting them to fight earlier on in their career is you have the excuse later on down the road if they do become really great fighters. Like Poirier McGregor, the reason you could set up that rematch so well is, yes, they both went on to have very successful careers, was that Dustin Poirier has improved so much since their first fight. If you match up Chris Daukaus and Tom Aspinall right now, let's say Tom Aspinall wins. Let's say TKO's Dacus in the second round. And then Dacus goes back. He beats three or four guys again. And they meet when Aspinall has the belt, or they do meet with both guys in the top five. You can repackage that rematch fairly easily and just say, listen, they both fought when they were earlier in their careers. It's no big deal. Like, I think Aspinall wins. I think he wins in the future. But I'd say they probably meet up when they are in that top five category. I think they're going to do, like, we'll build both of these guys up, and then we're going to make them fight each other for the title eliminator. Because right now, in my mind, either Derek Lewis is waiting or he's fighting Alexander Volkov. He's not going to fight the winner of Ciryl Gane and Jerzyna Rozenstruik next weekend. Like, that's what he's moved on to. For me, I see them, if they are going to fight for the title any day, I think they're going to fight each other. Like, I do think the UFC is going to wait and try to build both guys before they make them fight each other.
Let's do the notebook dump, talks about some broadcasting stuff. The only really things that stuck out to me, I want to talk about Herb Dean for a second, because you talked about Tyone in this way earlier. Herb Dean seems to get this shade, right? Where, like, you know, they felt like the Lewis punches were unnecessary, and he sort of threw it on Dean. He's a high-profile guy, right? So even if we think this way about Tyone, we're never going to really care, because he's not in those – like, Herb Dean – not that he's never – not that Chris Tony never does main events or anything, but more like Herb Dean is considered the gold standard right now. So when he does something, it's people are more critical of it. Do you think the criticism that he takes factors into his decision? Because he can't win. Either he stops it too early, he stops it too late. What do you think that is the answer here? Just like, honestly, I mean, people aren't going to stop criticizing him. Should he stop caring? Like, what's the – what's
I mean, I don't want to sound like Robin Black, but like, if you're anyone, you're going to care. Like, if your job is so under a microscope constantly, and you are responsible for, you know, kind of the health and not even kind of, but you are responsible for the health and safety of these fighters. The Derek Lewis one's weird, because yes, those shots were unnecessary, and yes, he was pretty far away, but there was no reason for Herb Dean to think that Derek Lewis was going to knock Curtis Blaydes out right then and there. You know what I mean? Like, I always go back to the Mark Goddard. He got a lot of flack for when Yoel Romero knocked out Luke Rockhold and hit him with that one big shot up against the cage. But you got to remember, in the position they were in that fight, they were behind the two black lines, but they had been in that position for the majority of the fight, and nothing had really happened. There was no major moment where one guy got dropped, and a finish was so, I guess, no one was really on the cusp of a finish. No one was on the cusp of a finish in that fight. No one was rocked or anything. Curtis Blaydes shoots for a takedown, gets hit by a shot. Really, it was just Derek Lewis landed the two shots. Like, I think Herb Dean did his best to get over there fast enough. I just think it was Lewis landed those two shots. And Herb Dean, listen, he makes a lot of fighters take a lot of damage they probably don't need. But I don't know if the stoppage last night was the worst of his career, if that makes any sense. I just think he was out of position, but there was no reason for him to think that Derek Lewis is going to land an uppercut from hell in that exact minute anyways.
So, yeah, I just want to cut in, guys, and I hate to cut you off, John, but I just want to ask you the question, Matt, because we got a couple of DMs at Fight Night Picks on Instagram. As always, I put it out there, geez, you know, bad stoppage, and then a couple of people thought, well, what was the bad stoppage? Or Herb Dean was so far out of place in the Derek Lewis fight because, like you said, didn't anticipate a finish. The fight that I was talking about was a Chris Dacus Alexei Oleinik fight. Like, Herb, what are you doing?
Yeah, but with Oleinik, it's one of those weird things. He was out on his feet, and we see this a lot in fights. Like, when do you know when a guy's out on his feet? Listen, I thought it probably should have stopped sooner, but a lot of those punches did hit his hands when they were up. Like, a lot did get through, but not all of them were just clean shots rocking his chin the whole time. Like, again, there's times to go after Herb Dean, but I don't think last night's the night that you can really point to and be like, he's the worst referee in MMA. He's definitely done a worse job than he did last night.
It was one of those nights where the officiating was off in the cage, the judging was off, and then if you had the chance to go and watch the Adrian Broner fight, even the referee in that fight kept saying, hey, stop talking, fight, and stop clinching, separate, as soon as they would clinch. So it was just a weird night in combat sports in general, but my main takeaways were the judging was poor, Tyone was poor, Herb Dean did a poor job. It was just it was a bad one all around in combat sports.
This guy's full of sunshine, man.
I was watching curling this morning. I might as well go full circle again. I was watching curling this morning. I don't know why. Big sport up here in Canada. And there's like a new team and one of the women's teams for one of the provinces. And anyways, they were just talking about like team chemistry, and they got a new coach, and they were just like, she's got to figure out to not make it about herself all the time. It's not about the name on the arm. It's just about the members. And that goes out to Craig.
All right, Matt, listen, we got another one next week. another big fight as this heavyweight division starts to take shape. Craig kind of alluded to it, but what are you guys looking at for this upcoming week in terms of a timetable? How you feel about bouncing back? Give me something. Craig just completely, you know, has me reach it for the Xanax. Can you, you know, make me feel good about this week coming up?
So here's the good news. Ciryl Gane, and I hate to keep on bringing Craig up, but Craig sometimes is right on a prospect. And Ciryl Gane's one of those prospects. He's 7-0. He's a well-rounded fighter. He's got crazy Muay Thai. I'm going to stop talking just to let Craig say his piece, and then I'll get back to what I was going to go on.
Listen, Matt, like, you know, we hype a lot of these prospects up, and that's our favorite part with Fight Night Picks. And John Franklin laughs about it, but we all kind of get a kick out of it, right? It's always, you feel very good when you're right about a prospect. Like, we hype Manon Fiorot up last month so much, and we talked about, you know, you got to watch out for the kicks, and you got to watch out for her stance, and you got to watch out for her pressure. And then she goes out and fights exactly that fight, and it's like, holy smokes, you're clairvoyant. And with Ciryl Gane, he came into the UFC at what, 3-0? And people are like, well, what's this guy? Like, how good's he really going to be? And then you talk about, oh, well, you know, he's a world-class kickboxer. He trains out of MMA Factory. There's probably something to this guy. He ruined the career of Adam Dyksa, who looked like Canada's next, you know, not GSP, but like he was fighting in Quebec. No, he was fighting in Quebec. He was talking about
this a pro boxer. This is why John Franklin and I do these
shows. He was undefeated. Like, Adam Dyksa was the guy. And Ciryl Gane completely derailed that. And then he comes into the UFC and he's finishing boxers on the mat by heel hook. And he's finishing, you know, world-class jiu-jitsu artists on the feet. And he's really bringing it together. Then he fights Tanner Boser, a point fighter. And he's able to have a point fight with him and beat him by decision. Then he just keeps going on and progressing. Here's the big opportunity for Ciryl Gane. We know how good his jiu-jitsu is. We know how good his power is, how reserved he can be on the feet. You saw that in the fight against Junior Dos Santos, where he just kind of waited to put it on. Here's the opportunity. You're taking on a guy that just beat Junior Dos Santos and finished him. You know how good Yarzino Rozenstruik is on the feet. So what wrinkle does Ciryl Gane have in his game to beat Yarzino Rozenstruik? Is it the grappling and the jiu-jitsu? Is it that he's going to outstrike the striker? Like, will something crazy like that happen? Now, Matt, I know you look like you're totally tuned out. We've been going
long. I'm here.
You think about this fight where Rozenstruik is such a good striker and Gane is so good, or seemingly so good at everything. That's what makes this fight interesting. I love this. I don't love the fact that Ciryl Gane is almost a 3-1 favorite. That seems ridiculous, but it's a great fight and it's a great card.
So, Craig, please stay on for this. And here's the thing. I'm going to call you out for a bit of a terrible NBA take, but you have to admit this at this point. DeMarcus Cousins is not a good player. Here's the thing. And you hyped him up for so much that I don't
think every team wants him right now, though.
No, they don't. There's a reason every team gets rid of him. But here's the thing. Your take on DeMarcus Cousins makes me devalue a lot of your takes in basketball. You said Ciryl Gane has a ground game comparable to John Jones if they ever fought. And just that point alone hurts a little bit. Like, I think he's okay in grappling. I don't think he's nearly as good as we sometimes hype him up to be. It's a very good main event. It's a perfect measuring stick for a guy like Ciryl Gane. And this is the best time to be an MMA fighter. Like, Luke Thomas, the one who talks about this. It's fun to watch a guy while he's on his way up. Like, it's no fun to become a guy's fan when he's already become the champ. This is your chance to really become a Ciryl Gane fan. If you haven't been paying attention, he can get it done on the feet. He can get it done on the ground. He's a really exciting guy. He looks like you want your heavyweight champ to look. He's got hand speed. He's got power. This is finally his opportunity to break through and consider himself an elite in the division. And that's what we have to look forward to this weekend.
This is what I'm talking about. These Allen boys don't stay down for long. They're already ready for the next card.
Darn right.
I love it. All right, guys. There you have it. One more in the win column. One more for the highlight reel. One more for Fight Night Picks. The recap show's in the books. Peace.
Let's get into it.